Thank you, David and Doug, and thanks to all of you for coming tonight. Thanks to friends and colleagues here from the scholarly community, from the world of philanthropy, from journalism, from the administration and Congress, and elsewhere in the policy community, and from the Center on Budget and Policy Priorities, my home away from home for the last 28 years. Speaking of home, I also want to thank my wonderful wife, Alyssa, who's also here tonight. Thanks most of all to the Academy. I'm both honored and surprised to receive the award. When Doug called me to tell me of the award, I first thought that the committee had made a mistake, that it had labored under some misinformation. Does the Academy know, I asked Doug, that I don't have a PhD? Doug allayed that concern, but I still find it daunting to receive an award in the name of Daniel Patrick Moynihan, who is such a towering figure, an inspiration to those of us who labor in his intellectual shadow. It's also somewhat daunting to find myself in the company of the two previous winners of the award, Alice Rivlin and David Elwood. As I'm sure all of you know, Alice has been a pioneer in the world of fiscal policy, the founding director of the Congressional Budget Office, the first woman to direct the Office of Management and Budget, and at the moment, she is both serving on the President's Fiscal Commission and co-chairing another fiscal commission for the Bipartisan Policy Center. No one can work on fiscal policy in this town without having both great admiration and great affection for Alice, for her dedication, her integrity, and her decency. As for David, my bonds with him are deep, and I'm so pleased that he is here tonight and that the Academy chose him as the person to give me the award. I still remember when I first encountered David's work. It was 84 or 85, and I came across a paper he was presenting entitled "Charles Murray, Did Robin Hood Ruin the Kingdom?" The paper was the first strong challenge I found to Charles Murray's losing ground, and I read through it with growing excitement, and I began searching for other things that this young scholar, Ed Elwood, had written. Soon, I was sending David's writings to congressional staff, journalists, and others, and urging them to read them, including the other really terrific paper I remember from the mid-'80s, a paper on poverty and welfare that David co-wrote with some other young economist, some fellow named, what was his name? Larry Summers. Incidentally, this mention of David's paper clearly highlights another area where I'm so much not a worthy successor of his. That's titles. I mean, did Robin Hood ruin the kingdom? And compare that to the Center on Budget and Policy. I was going to say that 30 years later, people are still telling me to come up with a better name, but David kind of beat me to it. Well, it's fair to say that David has had a profound impact on my thinking and that of others at the center. And he also helped us by serving for a number of years on the center's board, as did another honoree here tonight, another person who, like David, has done brilliant academic work, but still took the time to help us by serving on our board and offering her wisdom and guidance. So my great thanks and congratulations also to Rebecca Blank. Now, I remember the first time I saw Moynihan in action. I was a college senior. I was taking this incredible course taught by Eric Erickson. Now, Erickson gave two lectures a week, and the third, they called it a section, was a kind of a small class taught by an instructor or a graduate student. There were maybe 15 or 20 of these sections in the course. And a friend of mine advised me to go sign up for a particular section led by this earnest young psychiatrist in his late 20s by the name of Robert Coles. Coles was an amazing teacher and an even more amazing human being, and he quickly began to have a very large effect on me. Occasionally, I would drop by his office in the afternoon to see if he was free and had time to chat. And one day in late 1966, I stopped by his office just as he was walking out the door. He said, "I have to speak at a panel across town. Bob, why don't you come with me? You might find it interesting." As we drove to the event, Coles explained to me that Daniel Patrick Moynihan had issued a controversial report called The Negro Family, that some of his colleagues were upset by it, and that the panel had been arranged for Coles and Moynihan to debate it. Coles said to me that some of the event's sponsors probably expected him to take on Moynihan and the report. As I recall, Coles looked at me and said, "They are going to be disappointed." I didn't actually meet Pat Moynihan that day, but years later, when he was a senator, I found myself in his office from time to time, usually talking about poverty or welfare reform. As I was thinking about this evening's event, I recalled one such afternoon. I was sitting in his office, and I enthusiastically mentioned an article I had just read in an academic journal with an intriguing new perspective on welfare policy from a professor whose work I admired. Let's call him Professor X for reasons that will become apparent in a moment. When I mentioned the article, Senator Moynihan rose straight up from his chair, strode across the room to his bookcase, instantly picked the book he wanted, one he'd written a couple of decades earlier, and opened immediately to the page and the passage that he wanted. He read me a long excerpt that skewered certain modes of thinking. He closed the book, looked at me, and said dismissively, "Thus, Professor X." I quickly turned to another topic. As you know, Senator Moynihan was Washington's most prominent critic of the 1996 welfare law. He was a relentless critic of the old welfare system, but he feared that under the new system, a substantial number of poor children and their mothers would sink still deeper into poverty. In the years immediately after 1996, the conventional wisdom was that Moynihan and others who agreed with him, including us at the Center on Budget and a number of other people in this room, the conventional wisdom was that we had been proven dead wrong. The welfare rolls plummeted. Many families moved from welfare to work. Poverty among children declined markedly as well. But Moynihan believed that the truest test of the new law would come when times were hardest. And today in 2010, we can see that he had foresight and that the story is more complicated than the early celebrations of the 1996 law suggested. To be sure, the welfare law did prod and assist many families to move from welfare to work, and many benefited. But it also has had a downside. As Moynihan foresaw, large numbers of the least equipped and least functional families found themselves with neither earnings nor cash assistance, and they fell deeper into poverty. If you'll bear with me, a little data illustrate the point. In 1995, some 11.4 million children lived in deep poverty, that is, below half the poverty line before counting income from government benefit programs. In that same year, government benefits lifted all but 1.4 million of those children above half the poverty line. Fast forward 10 years later, in 2005, unemployment was lower than it had been in 95, and a somewhat smaller number of children, 9.7 million, lived below half the poverty line before taking government benefits into account. So that's nearly 2 million fewer than in 1995. But after counting government benefits, 2.4 million children remain below half the poverty line in 2005. In other words, although 1.7 million fewer children were in deep poverty before counting benefits, 1 million more were in deep poverty after the benefits were factored in. By the way, Becky, we did do these figures using the National Academy of Science panel recommended measure. So why did this occur? Well, the main reason appears to be the semi-collapse of cash welfare assistance. In the 80s and the first half of the 90s, about 80% of families eligible for cash assistance through the old AFDC program received it. But by 2005, only 40% of those eligible for cash assistance through the Temporary Assistance for Needy Families program, TANF, that replaced AFDC, only about 40% of those eligible for cash assistance through TANF got it. And the new system's performance in recessions has been even more troubling. In the 2001 recession and its aftermath, poverty rose and the food stamp and Medicaid rolls rose with it, but the cash assistance rolls did not. In many states, the number of poor families and children receiving cash public assistance actually fell even as unemployment climbed. And in the current downturn, this history began to repeat itself. In the first half of the recession, in the first part of this recession, poverty and unemployment soared, as did the food stamp rolls. But in about half the states, the number of families receiving TANF cash assistance barely rose at all or even fell. So in this case, as in so many others, Senator Moynihan turned out to have had more foresight than many of his critics. I think we all learned over the years that dismissing Senator Moynihan's judgments and predictions usually turned out to be a big mistake. Well, Senator Moynihan is now gone, but I think his spirit lives on in the work of many people. Early in 2009, the White House proposed and Congress approved as part of the Recovery Act a new $5 billion TANF emergency fund that is now providing additional resources to states to actually serve the rising number of families in need in the economic downturn through cash assistance and job creation. By this summer, states project that the fund will be subsidizing close to 180,000 jobs for low-income people who in most cases otherwise wouldn't have them. This fund really reflects Senator Moynihan's vision of both providing cash assistance to children in serious need and promoting the opportunity to work. Unfortunately, the fund is slated to expire on September 30th. Taking most of these jobs and the extra resources to provide assistance to the enlarged numbers of impoverished families and children with it, despite an unemployment rate that remains near 10%. The Obama administration has proposed a badly needed one-year extension of the fund. Congress has not yet determined whether to provide it. A decision is imminent. Maybe Senator Moynihan's expansive spirit can help inspire Congress to push this across the goal line. I do want to note that there are three people here tonight who played a large role in envisioning the emergency fund and making it a reality. First, Sharon Parent. I don't know which table Sharon is on. Sharon Parent, formerly of the Center on Budget, now Secretary Sebelius's top advisor on human services, who is sitting with her former teacher and mentor, another of tonight's honorees, Sheldon Danziger. Second, Jason Furman, Deputy Director of the National Economic Council at the White House, whose work in supporting the fund within the White House has been critical. And third, Ellen Nissenbaum, who has been my close colleague at the Center for the past 26 years, and design much of the legislative strategy on this for the Hill. All three of you, I think, deserve all of our time. Ladies and gentlemen, as you know, as a nation, we face enormous problems. These days, they seem almost overwhelming. And as I accept the award tonight and look out at this distinguished audience, I can't help but say something you already know. We're going to need academic research and analysis to help guide policy decisions to an even greater degree in the future than we have in the past. Our long-term fiscal situation is unsustainable, and wrenching changes are inescapable. The specific decisions that are made, sooner or later, on what those changes are, whom they affect, and how they work will have a large bearing on who and what we will become as a people and as a society. From a fiscal standpoint, the greatest need is to slow the rate of growth of healthcare costs. And in the landmark health reform law, policymakers enacted most of what we know how to do today to restrain healthcare costs without compromising healthcare quality and without rationing care largely by income. But to help us find ways to slow healthcare cost growth to a much greater degree in future years and decades, which will be essential, we will need to rely heavily on research, demonstrations, pilot projects, and the like. And we're also going to need more research and analysis on both the spending and the tax sides of the budget on what works and what doesn't, and for ideas on how to deliver services in new ways that are more economical and more efficient. Now, I know there's no assurance that policymakers will pay attention to the serious research and good ideas that may emerge from people like you, from think tanks, universities, and other research institutions across the country. I can only say that urging policymakers to pay attention to them will continue to be part of our mission at the Center on Budget. So, thank you again for this wonderful award, which I must say I'm not sure I deserve myself, but I accept on behalf of my dedicated, talented, and hardworking colleagues at the Center, three of whom I should note are here tonight. Susan Steinmetz, the Center's Associate Director, my right arm, and the person who keeps the Center functioning at such a high level as an institution year after year. Michelle Bazzi, our stellar Deputy Communications Director, and the remarkable Ellen Nissenbaum, whom I've already mentioned. In closing, I'd just like to leave you with a promise that, as we've tried to do in the past, my colleagues and I at the Center will be your partners in the future, endeavoring to help bring policy research and analysis to bear in policy debates in the extremely challenging times that lie ahead for our nation. Thank you very much.